Hello, my name is Jack Oldbury, and today I'm here to interview Dr. Tim Fryer from the Wolfson Brain Imaging Centre at the University of Cambridge. First, I'm here with the Naked Scientists, thanks to the David Ross Education Trust, of which my school, Skegness Grammar School, is a part. I've chosen to interview Dr. Fryer because I find his subject fascinating, in that we can combine sciences in order to gain an insight into what's going on inside our bodies. He peers into the body and brain using a technique called PET scanning, which we'll get around to explaining in a minute. I kick-started the interview asking, Tim, what kind of a scientist are you?
I'm a physicist. I have a degree in physics, and then briefly for 1 year I was working in nuclear physics at Birmingham University, and then I did a PhD in the physics of PET. And then thereafter I've been working in nuclear imaging, or nuclear medicine imaging, first in the NHS and now here as a physicist for the university.
Using his background in physics, Tim works on improving PET. Now, I'll just give a brief overview of PET for our listeners' benefit. PET stands for positron emission tomography, and is a process of imaging the workings of the body. Other imaging techniques, such as CT and MRI, look more at the anatomical or structural details of the body. PET starts off when we inject a radioisotope, or tracer, into a patient. This tracer is normally FDG, a glucose-based chemical, and this contains an unstable atom with too many protons. Because of this, a proton changes into a neutron and a positron. A positron is the antiparticle of an electron, and when a positron collides with an electron, which can be found inside the body, they annihilate. This produces two gamma rays travelling in opposite directions. A ring of detectors inside the PET scanner then detect these two gamma rays, and using data from all of the gamma rays that are produced, a computer can map a probable area of where the trace is, and hence where it is being used, to give a picture of what is going on inside the patient. Depending on what tracer is used, we can map different processes. As a glucose-based chemical, FDG can be used to show areas of high energy usage, as glucose acts as a fuel for the body's functions. We could also use different tracers to show what is happening in the brain by combining radioisotopes with chemicals used in the brain, allowing us to look at receptors, which may work differently for sufferers of certain conditions. Now we've got that covered, back to the interview. 40,000 people a year in England have a PET scan. Most of these are to help with the diagnosis of cancer, as initial imaging techniques do not give a clear picture. Tim explains this.
Sometimes they cannot tell. They have an idea there is a tumour somewhere, but they can't see it. Or they see one and they want to see, could there possibly be more which would have a big effect on patient management? Those people are then transferred or referred for a PET CT scan. Even though PET started off as a research tool, now most PET studies done worldwide are for diagnostic reasons.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, what does the patient do when they're having the scan?
Hopefully they lie still. Most of our studies, even the very shortest, is something like 20 minutes. If people move, the image is going to get blurred.
Is there anything they have to do in terms of food intake?
For FDG scans, because FDG is an analogue of glucose, we do not want people to have a high blood glucose level. It will then occupy transporters and less FDG will get into the tissue, and then we have poorer statistical quality. The images look noisier. So for an FDG scan, and this is really the only scan that this occurs, we ask people to fast for about 6 hours, so only to have water, and therefore we get better images for that. We do not have that problem with other tracers.
Okay then. So after that, how much detail can you see when a patient has had a scan?
The resolution of a machine like ours and similar PET CT machines is quoted at around 5 millimeters. It is not as high a resolution technique as MR and CT, both of whom have resolutions around a millimeter. If people move a lot, our effective resolution can be worse than that. On the other good side is that now, with mathematical techniques, we can model the limited resolution of the scanner and incorporate it in the reconstruction algorithm. And it is possible, if you have good statistical data, because this thing amplifies noise, to try and push it down so you're closer to 2 millimeters.
And it's this relatively good resolution, coupled with the fact that PET is a functional scanning technique, that makes PET very useful in neuroimaging. It can show how processes occur, specifically looking at changes in metabolism or how much energy is used. For example, CBD, or corticobasal degeneration, is a rare condition that causes the build-up of a protein named tau. This kills brain cells as it forms damaging clumps. This could be indicated through use of PET by identifying that the affected area has a lower metabolism than would be expected. As the tracer can feature different types of molecule, we can introduce different chemicals to the body and see how they work. This can be used as a research tool to see what happens in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or Parkinson's disease, or similar conditions. Returning to Tim, I asked him what he was most proud of having done over his career.
I'm proud to have got my PhD, I think. I think anyone who's done a PhD realises most particularly the nightmare of writing it up.
What part of your job do you love the most?
I find it fascinating. I find imaging fascinating and what it can achieve and how it's come in 40 years. And as I say, yeah, I'm glad I've ended up working. It's been a zigzaggy sort of route, you know, almost becoming a nuclear physicist and working at a nuclear reactor, but I'm glad I've ended up working in this. So that's what gets me up in the morning, yeah.
I asked him if there are any new developments happening in the world of PET scanning.
The one major thing, people have been working on it. In fact, the very first small experimental one was 17 years ago, but is actually to combine PET and MR in a single scanner. So we already have PET CT scanners, but that's quite simple. Literally, they are next to each other. They are not used simultaneously. When the X-ray is on, if it was near the PET detectors, there'd be a possibility of them essentially blowing them. So people are put onto a single bed, but just put between the two, but it is not done simultaneously. The final sort of piece, and one can't think of too many more combinations that we can have in the jigsaw, is to actually have a combined PET MR machine. But it is now, obviously, and the reason it's taken a lot longer, it is pretty difficult. There's had to be a complete redesign of the PET system to be able to work in the high magnetic field of the MR. And the reason that people are interested in PET MR so that they can work simultaneously. So there are some studies at the moment where we use PET and MR, but on separate scanners, areas where you might want to do them simultaneously. And although we have software to try to bring images together, they are not anywhere near as successful as in the brain. Your brain is a rigid box for non-rigid motion, which is basically everywhere apart from the brain, even the neck, for instance. So you can do them at the same time, so you have advantages of fusing the data. There are certain situations as well where you might want to do it at the same physiological state, which cannot be guaranteed if they're done one after the other. However, they are very expensive. They are £4.5 million, so to install them, about £5 million. People think it is unlikely that they will replace PET-CT as the big diagnostic workhorse, but that they may well find a niche in some studies for research and possibly even clinically. So that's the new thing that's arriving. But I don't think, and I think a lot of people don't think, it will remove PET-CT. PET-MR is actually worse, for instance, in the lung. PET-CTs are bought primarily for oncology, and you cannot have a system that is not good, you know, in lung cancers, for instance.
And we asked him, what do you think should come after PET-MR?
No, I think that's pretty much the end of it, because there are the three giants, PET, CT, and MR. I don't think anyone's particularly interested in an MR-CT scanner, for instance. So you've put PET with CT, and you've now put PET with MR. And it was an interesting talk a few years ago, which confirmed this. If you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, everything has been probed now. The last thing that was looked at was terahertz imaging, which I don't know too much about, but apparently it's quite good at telling you whether you have decay in your teeth and possibly has a role, more importantly, in skin cancer. But everything has been looked at now. So there are no new ones to come. The last 40 years has been this amazing period. So there's nothing left hiding away now. This final bit of combining them and refining them.
Well, I guess that's good now that we've got the complete set for the electromagnetic spectrum. Although it seems quite sad that there's not much else to do in that field, aside from the bits of tweaking, combining, and developing that you've mentioned. Thank you for your time, Dr. Fryer. I'm Jack Oldbury from Skegness Grammar School, and I've been with Dr. Hannah Critchlow at the Naked Scientists all week, as part of a David Ross Education Trust-sponsored work placement. This music is La Salsa des Immortels by Dan Waldkirk, Audrey Fisher, and Rob Fisher on the Intercontinental Music Lab.